said Maisie. "That may well prove to be an advantage," said Miss Munday. "Miss Tilly is most particular, and prefers to train her staff in her own way."
"Perhaps she'll think I'm too old or too young."
"You are neither too old nor too young," said Miss Munday, "and be assured, I wouldn't recommend you if I didn't think you were up to it. But I must warn you, Maisie, that Miss Tilly is a stickler for timekeeping. Be at the tea shop before 8 o'clock tomorrow. If you're late, that will not only be the first impression you make, but also the last." Maisie was standing outside Tilly's tea shop at 6 o'clock the following morning, and didn't budge for the next 2 hours. At 8:05, a plump, middle-aged, smartly dressed woman, with her hair arranged in a neat bun and a pair of half-moon spectacles propped on the end of her nose, turned the closed sign on the door to open, to allow a frozen Maisie to step inside.
"You've got the job, Mrs. Clifton," were her new boss's first words.
Harry was left in the care of his grandmother whenever Maisie went to work. Although she was only paid 9p an hour, she was allowed to keep half her tips, so that at the end of a good week she could take home as much as £3. There was also an unexpected bonus. Once the open sign had been turned back to closed at 6 o'clock in the evening, Miss Tilly would allow Maisie to take home any food that was left over. The word stale was never allowed to cross a customer's lips. After 6 months, Miss Tilly was so pleased with Maisie's progress that she put her in charge of her own station of 8 tables, and after another 6 months, several regulars would insist that Maisie served them. Miss Tilly solved the problem by increasing Maisie's allocation of tables to 12 and raising her pay to a shilling an hour. With 2 pay packets coming in each week, Maisie was once again able to wear both her engagement ring and her wedding ring, and the silver-plated tea strainer was back in its place. If Maisie was honest about it, Stan being released from prison for good behaviour after only 18 months turned out to be a bit of a mixed blessing. Harry, now aged 3½, had to move back into his mother's room, and Maisie tried not to think about just how peaceful it had been while Stan was away. Maisie was surprised when Stan got his old job back at the docks as if nothing had happened. This only convinced her that he knew far more about Arthur's disappearance than he let on, however much she pressed him. On one occasion, when she became a little too persistent, he belted her one. Although the following morning Miss Tilly pretended not to notice the black eye, one or two of the customers did, so Maisie never raised the subject with her brother again. But whenever Harry asked him about his father, Stan stuck to the family line and said, "Your old man was killed in the war. I was standing by his side when the bullet hit him." Maisie spent as much of her spare time with Harry as she could. She assumed that once he was old enough to attend Merriwood Elementary School, her life would become a lot easier. But taking Harry to school in the morning meant the added expense of a tram ride to make sure she was not late for work. She would then take a break in the afternoon so she could pick him up from school. Once Maisie had given him his tea, she would leave him in the care of his grandma and return to work. Harry had only been at school for a few days when Maisie noticed some cane marks on his backside while she was giving him his weekly bath.
"Who did that?" she demanded.
"The headmaster."
"Why?"
"Can't tell you, Mum."
When Maisie saw 6 new red stripes, even before the previous ones had faded, she questioned Harry again, but still he didn't let on. The 3rd time the marks appeared, she put on her coat and set off for Merriwood Elementary with the intention of giving his teacher a piece of her mind. Mr. Holcombe wasn't at all what Maisie had expected. To start with, he couldn't have been much older than she was, and he stood up when she entered the room. Not at all like the teachers she remembered from her days at Merriwood.
"Why is my son being caned by the headmaster?" she demanded, even before Mr. Holcombe had a chance to offer her a seat.
because he keeps playing truant, Mrs. Clifton. He disappears soon after morning assembly and gets back in time for football in the afternoon.
So where is he spending the day?
At the docks would be my guess, said Mr. Holcombe. Perhaps you might be able to tell me why.
Because his uncle works there, and he's always telling Harry that school is a waste of time because sooner or later he'll end up joining him at Barrington's.
I hope not, said Mr. Holcombe.
Why do you say that? Asked Maisie. It was good enough for his father.
That may well be, but it won't be good enough for Harry.
What do you mean? Maisie asked indignantly.
Harry is bright, Mrs. Clifton, very bright. If only I could persuade him to attend class more regularly, there's no saying what he might achieve.
Maisie suddenly wondered if she would ever find out which of the two men was Harry's father.
Some clever children don't discover how bright they are until after they left school, continued Mr. Holcombe, and then spend the rest of their lives regretting the wasted years. I want to make sure Harry does not fall into that category.
What would you like me to do? Asked Maisie, finally sitting down.
Encourage him to stay at school and not slope off to the docks every day. Tell him how proud you'd be if he did well in class and not only on the football field, which, just in case you didn't realize, Mrs. Clifton, isn't his forte.
His forte?
I do apologize. But even Harry must have worked out by now that he's never going to make the school 11, let alone play for Bristol City.
I'll do anything I can to help, promised Maisie.
Thank you, Mrs. Clifton, said Mr. Holcombe as Maisie rose to leave. If you felt able to encourage him, I've no doubt it would be far more effective in the long term than the headmaster's cane.
From that day, Maisie began to take a far greater interest in what Harry got up to at school. She enjoyed listening to his stories about Mr. Holcombe and what he'd taught him that day. And as the stripes didn't reappear, she assumed he must have stopped playing truant. And then, one night, just before going to bed, she checked on the sleeping child and found that the stripes were back, redder and deeper than before. She didn't need to go and see Mr. Holcombe, because he called in at the tea shop the following day.
"He managed to come to my class for a whole month," said Mr. Holcombe, "and then he disappeared again."
"But I don't know what more I can do," said Maisie helplessly. "I've already stopped his pocket money and told him not to expect another penny from me unless he stays at school. The truth is, his Uncle Stan has far more influence over him than I do."
"More's the pity," said Mr. Holcombe. "But I may have found a solution to our problem, Mrs. Clifton. However, it has no chance of succeeding without your full cooperation."
Maisie assumed that, although she was only 26, she would never marry again. After all, widows with a child in tow were not much of a catch when there were so many single women available. The fact that she always wore her engagement and wedding rings probably cut down the number of propositions she received at the tea shop, although one or two still tried it on. She didn't include dear old Mr. Craddock, who just liked to hold her hand. Mr. Atkins was one of Miss Tilly's regulars, and he liked to sit at one of the tables where Maisie was serving. He dropped in most mornings, always ordering a black coffee and a piece of fruitcake. To Maisie's surprise, after he'd paid his bill one morning, he invited her to the cinema.
"Greta Garbo in Flesh and the Devil," he said, trying to make it sound more tempting.
This wasn't the first time one of the customers had asked Maisie out, but it was the first time someone young and good-looking had shown any interest. In the past, her stock response had succeeded in putting off the most persistent of suitors.
"How kind of you, Mr. Atkins, but I like to spend any spare time I have with my son."
"Surely you can make an exception for just one evening," he said, not giving up quite as easily as the others. Maisie glanced quickly at his left hand. No sign of a wedding ring, or, even more damning, a pale circle revealing that one had been removed. She heard herself saying, "How kind of you, Mr. Atkins," and agreed to meet him on Thursday evening,
after she'd put Harry to bed. "Call me Eddie," he said, leaving a sixpenny tip. Maisie was impressed when Eddie turned up in a flat-nosed Morris to drive her to the cinema. And to her surprise, all he got up to while they sat together in the back row was to watch the film. She wouldn't have complained if he had put an arm around her shoulder. In fact, she was considering how far she would let him go on their first date. After the curtain came down, the organ lit up, and they all rose to sing the national anthem. "Care for a drink?" asked Eddie as they made their way out of the cinema. "I ought to be getting home before the trams pack up for the night." "You don't have to worry about the last tram, Maisie, when you're with Eddie Atkins." "All right, then, just a quick one," she said, as he guided her across the road to the Red Bull. "So what do you do, Eddie?" Maisie asked, as he placed a half pint of orange squash on the table in front of her. "I'm in the entertainment business," he said, without going into any detail. Instead, he switched the subject back to Maisie. "I don't have to ask what you do." After a second orange juice, he looked at his watch and said, "I got an early start tomorrow, so I'd better get you home." On the way back to Stillhouse Lane, Maisie chatted about Harry and how she was hoping he would join the choir at Holy Nativity. Eddie seemed genuinely interested, and when he brought the car to a halt outside number 27, she waited for him to kiss her. But he just jumped out, opened the car door for her, and accompanied Maisie to her front door. Maisie sat at the kitchen table and told her mother everything that had happened, or not happened, that night. All Grandma had to say was, "What's his game?" Chapter 13. When Maisie saw Mr. Holcomb walk into Holy Nativity, accompanied by a smartly dressed man, she assumed that Harry must be in trouble again. She was surprised, because there hadn't been any red marks for over a year. She braced herself as Mr. Holcomb headed towards her, but the moment he saw Maisie, he simply gave her a shy smile before he and his companion slipped into the third pew on the other side of the aisle. From time to time, Maisie glanced across to look at them, but she didn't recognize the other man, who was considerably older than Mr. Holcomb. She wondered if he might be the headmaster of Merriwood Elementary. When the choir rose to sing the first anthem, Miss Munday glanced in the direction of the two men before nodding to the organist to show that she was ready. Maisie felt that Harry excelled himself that morning, but she was surprised when a few minutes later he rose to sing a second solo, and even more surprised when he performed a third. Everyone knew that Miss Munday never did anything unless there was a reason, but it still wasn't clear to Maisie what that reason might be. After the Reverend Watts had blessed his flock at the end of the service, Maisie remained in her place and waited for Harry to appear, hoping he'd be able to tell her why he'd been asked to sing three solos. As she chatted anxiously to her mother, her eyes never left Mr. Holcomb, who was introducing the older man to Miss Munday and the Reverend Watts. A moment later, the Reverend Watts led the two men into the vestry. Miss Munday marched down the aisle towards Maisie, a resolute look on her face, which every parishioner knew meant she was on a mission. "Can I have a private word with you, Mrs. Clifton?" she asked. She didn't give Maisie a chance to reply, but simply turned and walked back down the aisle towards the vestry. Eddie Atkins hadn't shown his face in Tilly's for over a month, but then one morning he reappeared and took his usual seat at one of Maisie's tables. When she came over to serve him, he gave her a huge smile, as if he'd never been away. "Good morning, Mr. Atkins," Maisie said, as she opened her notepad. "What can I get for you?" "My usual," said Eddie. "It's been so long, Mr. Atkins," said Maisie. "You'll have to remind me." "I'm sorry I haven't been in touch, Maisie," said Eddie, "but I had to go to America, rather short notice, and only got back last night." She wanted to believe him, Maisie had already admitted to her mother that she was a little disappointed she hadn't heard from Eddie after he'd taken her to the cinema. She'd enjoyed his company and felt the evening had gone rather well. Another man had started visiting the tea shop regularly, and like Eddie, he would only sit at one of Maisie's tables. Although she couldn't help noticing that he was showing considerable interest in her, she didn't give him any encouragement, because not only was he middle-aged, but he was also wearing a wedding ring. He had a detached air about him, like a solicitor who is studying a client, and whenever he spoke to her, he sounded a little pompous. Maisie could hear her mother asking, "What's his game?" But perhaps she'd misunderstood his intentions, because he never once tried to strike up a conversation with her. Even Maisie couldn't resist a grin when, a week later, both of her suitors dropped in for a coffee on the same morning, and both asked if they could meet up with her later. Eddie was first, and he got straight to the point. "Why don't I pick you up after work this evening, Maisie? There's something I'm rather keen to show you." Maisie wanted to tell him she already had a date, just to make him realize she wasn't available whenever it suited him. But when she returned to his table a few minutes later with his bill, she found herself saying, "I'll see you after work then, Eddie." She still had a smile on her face when the other customer said, "I wonder if I might have a word with you, Mrs. Clifton." Maisie wondered how he knew her name. "Wouldn't you prefer to speak to the manageress, Mr. Frampton?" he replied. "No, thank you. It's you I was hoping to speak to. Might I suggest we meet at the Royal Hotel during your afternoon break? It shouldn't take more than 15 minutes of your time." "Talk about buses never turning up when you need one," Maisie said to Miss Tilly, "and then two arrive at once." Miss Tilly told Maisie she thought she recognized Mr. Frampton, but couldn't place him. When Maisie presented Mr. Frampton with his bill, she emphasized that she could only spare 15 minutes because she had to be on time to pick up her son from school at 4 o'clock. He nodded, as if that was something else he was aware of. Was it really in Harry's best interests to apply for a scholarship to St. Bede's? Maisie wasn't sure who to discuss the problem with. Stan was bound to be against the idea and wasn't likely to consider the other side of the argument. Miss Tilly was too close a friend of Miss Munday's to give a dispassionate view, and the Reverend Watts had already advised her to seek the Lord's guidance, which hadn't proved particularly reliable in the past. Mr. Frobisher had seemed such a nice man, but he'd made it clear that only she could make the final decision. Mr. Holcomb hadn't left her in any doubt how he felt. Maisie didn't give Mr. Frampton another thought until she'd finished serving her last customer. She then exchanged a pinafore for her old coat. Miss Tilly watched through the window as Maisie set off in the direction of the Royal Hotel. She felt a little anxious, but wasn't sure why. Although Maisie had never been in the Royal before, she knew it had the reputation of being one of the best-run hotels in the West Country, and the chance to see it from the inside was one of the reasons she'd agreed to see Mr. Frampton. She stood on the opposite pavement and watched as customers pushed their way through the revolving doors. She'd never seen anything quite like them, and only when she felt confident she'd got the hang of how they worked did she cross the road and step inside. She pushed a little too hard and found herself propelled into the foyer more quickly than she'd anticipated. Maisie looked around and spotted Mr. Frampton sitting alone in a quiet alcove in the corner of the foyer. She walked across to join him. He immediately rose from his place, shook hands with her, and waited until she had taken the seat opposite him. "Can I order you a coffee, Mrs. Clifton?" he asked, and before she could reply he added, "I should warn you, it's not in the same class as Tilly's." "No, thank you, Mr. Frampton," said Maisie, whose only interest was to find out why he wanted to see her. Mr. Frampton took his time lighting a cigarette, then inhaled deeply. "Mrs. Clifton," he began as he placed the cigarette on the ashtray, "you cannot have failed to notice that I have recently become a regular customer at Tilly's." Maisie nodded. "I have to confess that my only reason for visiting the cafe was you." Maisie had her well-prepared amorous suitor line ready for just as soon as he stopped talking. "In all the years I've been in the hotel trade," he continued, "I've never seen anyone do their job more efficiently than you. I only wish that every waitress in this hotel was of your caliber."
"I've been well trained," said Maisie. "So have the other four waitresses in that tea shop, but none of them has your flair."
"I'm flattered, Mr. Frampton, but why are you telling—"
"I am the general manager of this hotel," he said, "and I'd like you to take charge of our coffee room, which is known as the Palm Court. As you can see," he waved a hand expansively, "we have about 100 covers, but less than a third of the places are regularly occupied. That's not exactly a worthwhile return on the company's investment. No doubt that would change if you were to take over. I believe I can make it worth your while."
Maisie didn't interrupt him.
"I can't see why your hours should differ greatly from those of your current employment. I'd be willing to pay you £5 a week, and all the tips earned by the waitresses in the Palm Court would be split 50-50 with you. If you were able to build up the clientele, that could prove very remunerative, and then I—"
"But I couldn't think of leaving Miss Tilly," interrupted Maisie. "She's been so good to me over the past 6 years."
"I fully appreciate your feelings, Mrs. Clifton. Indeed, I would have been disappointed if that had not been your immediate response. Loyalty is a trait I greatly admire. However, you must not only consider your own future, but also your son's, should he take up the offer of a choral scholarship to St. Bede's." Maisie was speechless.
When Maisie finished work that evening, she found Eddie sitting in his car outside the tea shop, waiting for her. She noticed that he didn't jump out to open the passenger door this time.
"So where are you taking me?" she asked, as she climbed in beside him.
"It's a surprise," said Eddie as he pressed the starter, "but I don't think you'll be disappointed."
He pushed the gear lever into first and headed towards a part of the city that Maisie hadn't visited before. A few minutes later, he drove into a side alley and came to a halt outside a large oak door below a neon sign that announced in glowing red letters, "Eddie's Nightclub."
"This is yours?" asked Maisie.
"Every square inch," said Eddie proudly. "Come inside and see for yourself."
He leapt out of the car, opened the front door, and led Maisie inside.
"This used to be a granary," he explained as he took her down a narrow wooden staircase. "But now that ships can no longer sail this far up the river, the company's had to move, so I was able to pick up their lease for a very reasonable price."
Maisie entered a large, dimly lit room. It was some time before her eyes had adjusted well enough to take it all in. There were half a dozen men sitting on high leather stools drinking at the bar, and almost as many waitresses fluttering around them. The wall behind the bar consisted of a vast mirror, giving the impression the room was far larger than it actually was. At the center was a dance floor, surrounded by plush velvet banquettes that would just about seat two people. At the far end was a small stage with a piano, double bass, a set of drums, and several music stands. Eddie took a seat at the bar. Looking around the room, he said, "This is why I've been spending so much time in America. Speakeasies like this are springing up all over New York and Chicago. They're making a fortune." He lit a cigar. "And I promise you, there won't be anything else like this in Bristol, that's for sure."
"That's for sure," Maisie repeated as she joined him at the bar, but didn't attempt to climb up onto one of the high stools.
"What's your poison, doll?" said Eddie, in what he imagined to be an American accent.
"I don't drink,"
Maisie reminded him.
That's one of the reasons I chose you.
Chose me?
Sure. You'd be the ideal person to take charge of the cocktail waitresses. Not only would I pay you £6 a week, but if the place takes off, the tips alone would be more than you could ever hope to earn at Tilly's.
Would I be expected to dress like that? Asked Maisie, pointing to one of the waitresses who was wearing an off-the-shoulder red blouse and a tight-fitting black skirt that barely covered her knees. It amused Maisie that they were the same colours as the St. Bede's uniform.
Why not? You're a great-looking broad, and the punters will pay good money to be served by someone like you. You'll get the odd proposition, of course, but I feel sure you can handle that.
What's the point of a dance floor if it's a men-only club?
Another idea I picked up from the States, said Eddie. If you want to dance with one of the cocktail waitresses, it'll cost you.
And what else does that cost include?
That's up to them, said Eddie, with a shrug of the shoulders. So long as it doesn't take place on the premises, nothing to do with me, he added, laughing a little too loudly.
Maisie didn't laugh.
So, what do you think? He asked.
I think I'd better be getting home, said Maisie. I didn't have time to let Harry know I'd be late.
Whatever you say, honey, said Eddie. He draped an arm around her shoulder and led her out of the bar and back up the stairs.
As he drove her to Stillhouse Lane, he told Maisie about his plans for the future.
I've already got my eye on a second sight, he said excitedly, so the sky's the limit.
The sky's the limit, Maisie repeated as they drew up outside number 27. Maisie jumped out of the car and walked quickly to the front door.
So, will you need a few days to think it over? Said Eddie, chasing after her.
No, thank you, Eddie, said Maisie without hesitation. I've already made up my mind, she added, taking a key out of her handbag. Eddie grinned and put an arm around her.
I didn't think it would be a difficult decision for you to make.
Maisie removed the arm, smiled sweetly, and said,
It's kind of you to consider me, honey, but I think I'll stick to serving coffee.
She opened her front door before adding, But thanks for asking.
Anything you say, doll. But if you change your mind, my door is always open.
Maisie closed the door behind her. Chapter 14. Maisie finally settled on the one person she felt she could seek advice from. She decided to turn up at the docks unannounced and hope he'd be around when she knocked on his door. She didn't tell either Stan or Harry who she was visiting. One of them would try to stop her, while the other would feel she'd betrayed a confidence. Maisie waited until her day off, and once she had dropped Harry at school, she took a tram to the dockyard. She had chosen her time carefully. Late morning, when he was still likely to be in his office, while Stan would be fully occupied loading or unloading cargo at the other end of the dock. Maisie told the man on the gate that she'd come to apply for a job as a cleaner. He pointed indifferently towards the red brick building and still didn't remember her. As she walked towards Barrington House, Maisie looked up at the windows on the fifth floor and wondered which office was his. She recalled her encounter with Mrs. Nettles and the way she had been shown the door the moment she mentioned her name. Now Maisie not only had a job she enjoyed and where she was respected, but she'd had two other offers in the past few days. She didn't give Mrs. Nettles another thought as she walked straight past the building and continued along the quayside. Maisie didn't slacken her pace until she could see his home. She found it hard to believe that anyone could possibly live in a railway carriage, and began to wonder if she'd made a dreadful mistake. Had Harry's stories of a dining room, a bedroom, and even a library been exaggerated?
You can't stop now you've come this far, Maisie Clifton, she told herself,
and knocked boldly on the carriage door.
Come in, Mrs. Clifton, said a gentle voice.
Maisie opened the door to find an old man sitting in a comfortable seat, with books and other possessions scattered around him. She was surprised how clean the carriage was, and realized that, despite Stan's claims, it was she, and not old Jack, who lived in third class. Stan had perpetuated a myth that had been ignored when viewed through the eyes of an unprejudiced child. Old Jack immediately rose from his place and beckoned her towards the seat opposite. "You'll have come to see me about young Harry, no doubt." "Yes, Mr. Tarr," she replied. "Let me guess," he said. "You can't make up your mind whether he should go to St. Bede's or remain at Merriwood Elementary." "How could you possibly know that?" asked Maisie. "Because I've been considering the same problem for the past month," said old Jack. "So what do you think he should do?" "I think that despite the many difficulties he will undoubtedly face at St. Bede's, if he doesn't take this opportunity, he could well spend the rest of his life regretting it. Perhaps he won't win a scholarship, and the decision will be taken out of our hands." "The decision was taken out of our hands," said old Jack, "the moment Mr. Frobisher heard young Harry sing. But I have a feeling that wasn't the only reason you came to see me." Maisie was beginning to understand why Harry admired this man so much. "You're quite right, Mr. Tarr. I need your advice on another matter. Your son calls me Jack, except when he's cross with me. Then he calls me Old Jack." Maisie smiled. "I'd been worried that even if he did win a scholarship, I wasn't earning enough for Harry to have all the little extras that the other boys at a school like St. Bede's take for granted. But fortunately, I've just been offered another job which would mean more money." "And you're worried about how Miss Tilly will react when you tell her you're thinking of leaving." "You know Miss Tilly?" "No, but Harry has spoken of her many times. She's clearly from the same mould as Miss Munday, and let me assure you that's a limited edition. There's no need for you to concern yourself." "I don't understand," said Maisie. "Allow me to explain," said old Jack. "Miss Munday has already invested a great deal of her time and expertise in making sure that Harry not only wins a scholarship to St. Bede's, but, far more important, goes on to prove himself worthy of it. My bet is that she will have discussed every possible eventuality with her closest friend, who just happens to be Miss Tilly. So when you tell her about the new job, you may well find it doesn't come as a complete surprise." "Thank you, Jack," said Maisie. "How lucky Harry is to have you as a friend. The father he never knew," she said softly. "That is the nicest compliment I've received for a good many years," said old Jack. "I'm only sorry that he lost his father in such tragic circumstances." "Do you know how my husband died?" "Yes, I do," replied old Jack, aware that he should never have raised the subject. He quickly added, "but only because Harry told me." "What did he tell you?" asked Maisie anxiously. "That his father was killed in the war." "But you know that's not true," said Maisie. "Yes, I do," said old Jack, "and I suspect Harry also knows his father couldn't have died in the war." "Then why doesn't he say so?" "He probably thinks there's something you don't want to tell him." "But I don't know the truth myself," admitted Maisie. Old Jack didn't comment. Maisie walked slowly home, one question answered, another still unresolved. Even so, she wasn't in any doubt that old Jack could be added to the list of people who knew the truth about what had happened to her husband. Old Jack turned out to be right about Miss Tilly, because when Maisie told her about Mr. Frampton's offer, she couldn't have been more supportive and understanding. "We'll all miss you," she said, and frankly, the Royal is lucky to have you.
How can I begin to thank you for all you've done for me over the years? Said Maisie.
It's Harry who should be thanking you, said Miss Tilly, and I suspect it will only be a matter of time before he realizes that.
Maisie started her new job a month later, and it didn't take her long to discover why the Palm Court was never more than a third full. The waitresses regarded their work simply as a job, unlike Miss Tilly, who considered it to be a vocation. They never bothered to remember the customers' names or their favourite tables. Worse, the coffee was often cold by the time it was served, and the cakes were left to go stale until someone bought them. Maisie wasn't surprised they didn't get any tips. They didn't deserve them. After another month, she began to realize just how much Miss Tilly had taught her. After 3 months, Maisie had replaced 5 of the 7 waitresses without having to recruit anyone from Tilly's. She had also ordered smart new uniforms for all her staff, along with new plates, cups and saucers, and even more important, changed her coffee supplier and her cake maker. That was something she was willing to steal from Miss Tilly.
"You're costing me a lot of money, Maisie," said Mr. Frampton when another stack of bills landed on his desk. "Try not to forget what I said about return on investment."
"Give me another 6 months, Mr. Frampton, and you'll see the results."
Although Maisie worked night and day, she always found time to drop Harry off at school in the morning and pick him up in the afternoon. But she warned Mr. Frampton that there would be one day when she wouldn't be on time for work. When she told him why, he gave her the whole day off.
Just before they left the house, Maisie checked herself in the mirror. She was dressed in her Sunday best, but not going to church. She smiled down at her son, who looked so smart in his new red and black school uniform. Even so, she felt a little self-conscious as they waited at the tram stop.
2 to Park Street, she told the Clippy when the number 11 pulled away.
She was unable to hide her pride when she noticed him taking a closer look at Harry. It only convinced Maisie that she had made the right decision. When they reached their stop, Harry refused to let his mum carry his suitcase. Maisie held on to his hand as they walked slowly up the hill towards the school, not sure which one of them was more nervous. She couldn't take her eyes off the hansom cabs and chauffeur-driven cars that were dropping off other boys for their first day of term. She only hoped that Harry would be able to find at least one friend among them. After all, some of the nannies were better dressed than she was. Harry began to slow down as they got nearer the school gates. Maisie could sense his discomfort, or was it just fear of the unknown?
"I'll leave you now," she said, and bent down to kiss him. "Good luck, Harry. Make us all proud of you."
"Goodbye, Mum."
As she watched him walk away, Maisie noticed that someone else appeared to be taking an interest in Harry Clifton.
Chapter 15. Maisie would never forget the first time she had to turn away a customer. "I'm sure there will be a table available in a few minutes, sir." She prided herself on the fact that once a customer had paid the bill, her staff could clear the table, replace the cloth, and have it relaid and ready for the next guest within 5 minutes. The Palm Court quickly became so popular that Maisie had to keep a couple of tables permanently reserved, just in case one of her regulars turned up unexpectedly. She was a little embarrassed that some of her old customers from Tilly's had begun to migrate to the Palm Court, not least dear old Mr. Craddock, who remembered Harry from his paper round. She considered it an even greater compliment when Miss Tilly herself began to drop in for a morning coffee. "Just checking on the opposition," she said. "By the way, Maisie, this coffee is superb."
"So it should be," Maisie replied. "It's yours."
Eddie Atkins also came in from time to time, and if the size of his cigars, not to mention his waistline, was anything to go by, the sky must still have been the limit. Although he was friendly, he never asked Maisie out, but he did regularly remind her that his door was always open. Not that Maisie didn't have a string of admirers she occasionally allowed to take her out in the evening. Maybe to dinner at a fashionable restaurant. Sometimes a visit to the Old Vic or the cinema, especially if a Greta Garbo film was playing. But when they parted at the end of the evening, she allowed none of them more than a peck on the cheek before returning home. At least, not until she met Patrick Casey, who proved that the charm of the Irish was not just a cliché. When Patrick first walked into the Palm Court, hers wasn't the only head that turned to take a closer look. He was a shade over 6 foot, with wavy dark hair and the build of an athlete. That would have been enough for most women, but it was the smile that captivated Maisie, as she suspected it had many others. Patrick told her he was in finance, but then Eddie had said he was in the entertainment business. His work brought him to Bristol once or twice a month, when Maisie would allow him to take her to dinner, the theatre or the cinema, and occasionally she even broke her golden rule and didn't take the last tram back to Stillhouse Lane. She wouldn't have been surprised to discover that Patrick had a wife and half a dozen offspring back at home in Cork, although he swore, hand on heart, that he was a bachelor. Whenever Mr. Holcomb dropped into the Palm Court, Maisie would guide him to a table in the far corner of the room that was partly obscured by a large pillar and was shunned by her regulars. But its privacy allowed her to bring him up to date on how Harry was getting on. Today, he seemed more interested in the future than the past, and asked, "Have you decided what Harry will do once he leaves St. Bede's?" "I haven't given it much thought," Maisie admitted. "After all, it's not for some time." "It's soon enough," said Mr. Holcomb, "and I can't believe you'll want him to return to Merriwood Elementary." "No, I don't," said Maisie firmly. "But what choice is there?" "Harry says he'd like to go to Bristol Grammar School, but if he fails to win a scholarship, he's worried that you won't be able to afford the fees." "That won't be a problem," Maisie assured him. "With my present pay, combined with the tips, no one need know his mother is a waitress." "Some waitress," said Mr. Holcomb, looking around the packed room. "I'm only surprised you haven't opened your own place." Maisie laughed, and didn't give it another thought, until she had an unexpected visit from Miss Tilly. Maisie attended matins at St. Mary Redcliffe every Sunday, so she could hear her son sing. Miss Munday had warned her that it wouldn't be much longer before Harry's voice broke, and she mustn't assume that a few weeks later he'd be singing tenor solos. Maisie tried to concentrate on the canon's sermon that Sunday morning, but found her mind drifting. She glanced across the aisle to see Mr. and Mrs. Barrington sitting with their son, Giles, and two young girls, who she assumed must be their daughters, but whose names she didn't know. Maisie had been surprised when Harry told her that Giles Barrington was his closest friend. Nothing more than a coincidence of the alphabet had put them together in the first place, he'd said. She hoped it would never become necessary for her to tell him that Giles might be more than just a good friend. Maisie often wished she could do more to help Harry with his efforts to win a scholarship to Bristol Grammar School. Although Miss Tilly had taught her how to read a menu, add and subtract, and even write a few simple words, just the thought of what Harry must be putting himself through filled her with trepidation. Miss Munday boosted Maisie's confidence by continually reminding her that Harry would never have got this far if she hadn't been willing to make so many sacrifices. "And in any case," she added, "you're every bit as clever as Harry. You just haven't been given the same opportunities." Mr. Holcomb kept her informed on what he described as the timing, and as the date of the examination drew nearer, Maisie became just as nervous as the candidate.
she realized the truth of one of old Jack's remarks, that often the onlooker suffers even more than the participant. The Palm Court room was now packed every day. But it didn't stop Maisie from initiating even more changes in a decade the press were describing as the frivolous 30s. In the morning, she had started offering her customers a variety of biscuits to go with their coffee, and in the afternoon, her tea menu was proving just as popular, especially after Harry told her that Mrs. Barrington had given him the choice of Indian or China tea. However, Mr. Frampton vetoed the suggestion that smoked salmon sandwiches should appear on the menu. Every Sunday, Maisie would kneel on her little cushion. Her one prayer was to the point. "Please, God, make sure Harry wins a scholarship. If he does, I'll never ask you for anything again." With a week to go to the exams, Maisie found she couldn't sleep and lay awake wondering how Harry was coping. So many customers wanted to pass on their best wishes to him, some because they had heard him singing in the church choir, others because he'd delivered their morning papers, or simply because their own children had been, were, or would at some time in the future be going through the same experience. It seemed to Maisie that half of Bristol was taking the exam. On the morning of the examination, Maisie placed several regulars at the wrong table, gave Mr. Craddock coffee instead of his usual hot chocolate, and even presented two customers with someone else's bill. No one complained. Harry told her he thought he'd done quite well, but he couldn't be certain if he'd done well enough. He mentioned someone called Thomas Hardy, but Maisie wasn't sure if he was a friend or one of the masters. When the long case clock in the Palm Court room struck 10 on that Thursday morning, Maisie knew the headmaster would be posting the exam results on the school notice board. But it was another 22 minutes before Mr. Holcombe walked into the room and headed straight for his usual table behind the pillar. Maisie could not tell how Harry had done from the expression on the schoolmaster's face. She quickly crossed the room to join him, and for the first time in 4 years sat down in the seat opposite a customer, although collapsed might be a more accurate description. "Harry has passed with distinction," said Mr. Holcombe, "but I'm afraid he just missed out on a scholarship." "What does that mean?" Maisie asked, trying to stop her hands from trembling. The top 12 candidates had marks of 80% or above and were all awarded open scholarships. In fact, Harry's friend Deakins came top with 92%. Harry achieved a very commendable 78% and came 17th out of 300. Mr. Frobisher told me his English paper let him down.
"He should have read Hardy instead of Dickens," said a woman who'd never read a book.
"Harry will still be offered a place at BGS," said Mr. Holcombe, "but he won't receive the annual £100 a year scholars grant." Maisie rose from her place.
"Then I'll just have to work 3 shifts instead of 2, won't I? Because he's not going back to Merriwood Elementary, Mr. Holcombe. I can tell you that."
Over the next few days, Maisie was surprised by how many regulars offered their congratulations on Harry's magnificent achievement. She also discovered that one or two of her customers had children who had failed to pass the exam, in one case by a single percentage point. They would have to settle for their second choice. It made Maisie all the more determined that nothing would stop Harry reporting to Bristol Grammar School on the first day of term. One strange thing she noticed during the next week was that her tips doubled. Dear old Mr. Craddock slipped her a £5 note, saying, "For Harry, may he prove worthy of his mother." When the thin white envelope dropped through the letterbox in Stillhouse Lane, an event in itself, Harry opened the letter and read it to his mother. Clifton H. had been offered a place in the A stream for the Michaelmas term, starting on September the 15th. When he came to the last paragraph, which asked Mrs. Clifton to write and confirm whether the candidate wished to accept or reject the offer, he looked nervously at her.
"You must write back straight away, accepting the offer," she said. Harry threw his arms around her and whispered, "I only wish my father was alive."
"Perhaps he is," thought Maisie. A few days later, a second letter landed on the doormat. This one detailed a long list of items that had to be purchased before the first day of term. Maisie noticed that Harry seemed to require two of everything, in some cases three or more, and in one case six. Socks. Grey calf length. Plus garters.
"Pity you can't borrow a pair of my suspenders," she said. Harry blushed.
A third letter invited new pupils to select three extracurricular activities from a list ranging from the car club to the combined cadet force, some of which involved an added charge of £5 per activity. Harry chose the choir, for which there was no extra charge, as well as the theatre club and the Arts Appreciation Society. The latter included a proviso that any visits to galleries outside Bristol would incur an extra cost. Maisie wished there were a few more Mr. Craddocks around, but she never allowed Harry to suspect there was any reason for concern, even though Mr. Holcombe reminded her that her boy would be at Bristol Grammar School for the next 5 years. The first member of the family not to leave school before the age of 14, she told him. Maisie braced herself for another visit to T.C. Marsh, Tailors of Distinction. By the time Harry was fully kitted out and ready for the first day of term, Maisie had once again begun to walk to and from work, saving 5 pence a week on tram fares, or, as she told her mother, £1 a year, enough to pay for a new suit for Harry. Parents, Maisie had learnt over the years, may be considered an unfortunate necessity by their offspring, but more often than not they are also an embarrassment. On her first speech day at St. Bede's, Maisie had been the only mother not wearing a hat. After that, she had bought one from a second-hand shop, and however out of fashion it would become, it was going to have to last until Harry left Bristol Grammar School. Harry had agreed that she should accompany him to school on the first day of term, but Maisie had already decided that he was old enough to catch a tram home in the evening. Her main anxiety was not about how Harry would get to and from school, but what to do with him in the evenings now he was a day boy and would no longer be sleeping at school during term. She had no doubt that if he went back to sharing a room with his Uncle Stan, it could only end in tears. She tried to put the problem out of her mind as she prepared for Harry's first day in his new school. Hat in place, best and only overcoat recently cleaned, sensible black shoes with the only pair of silk stockings she possessed, Maisie felt ready to face the other parents. When she came down the stairs, Harry was already waiting for her by the door. He looked so smart in his new uniform of claret and black that she would have liked to parade him up and down Stillhouse Lane so the neighbours would know that someone from the street was going to Bristol Grammar School. As they had on his first day at St. Bede's, they caught the tram, but Harry asked Maisie if they could get off one stop before University Road. She was no longer allowed to hold his hand, although she did straighten his cap and tie more than once. When Maisie first saw the noisy gathering of young men crowded around the school gates, she said, "I'd better be off, or I'll be late for work," which puzzled Harry, because he knew Mr. Frampton had given her the day off. She gave her son a quick hug, but kept a wary eye on him as he made his way up the hill. The first person to greet him was Giles Barrington. Maisie was surprised to see him, as Harry had told her he would probably be going to Eton. They shook hands like a couple of grown men who had just closed an important deal. Maisie could see Mr. and Mrs. Barrington standing at the back of the crowd. Was he making sure he avoided her? A few minutes later, Mr. and Mrs. Deakins joined them, accompanied by the Pelequin Memorial Scholar. More handshakes, left-handed in Mr. Deakin's case. As the parents began to take leave of their children, Maisie watched Mr. Barrington as he shook hands first with his son and then with Deakins, but turned away when Harry offered his hand. Mrs. Barrington looked embarrassed, and Maisie wondered if she might later ask why Hugo had ignored Giles's closest friend. If she did, Maisie felt certain he would not tell her the real reason. Maisie feared it couldn't be long before Harry asked why Mr. Barrington always snubbed him. As long as only three people knew the truth, she couldn't think of any reason why Harry would ever find out. Chapter 16. Miss Tilly had become such a regular at the Palm Court that she even had her own table. She would usually arrive around 4 o'clock and order a cup of tea, Earl Grey, and a cucumber sandwich. She always declined to take anything from the large assortment of cream cakes, jam tarts, and chocolate eclairs, but would occasionally allow herself a buttered scone. When she popped by just before 5 one evening, unusually late for her, Maisie was relieved that her usual table was free. "I wonder if I might sit somewhere a little more discreet today, Maisie. I need to have a quiet word with you." "Of course, Miss Tilly," said Maisie, and led her to Mr. Holcomb's preferred table behind the pillar at the far end of the room. "I'm off in 10 minutes," Maisie told her. "I'll join you then." When her deputy, Susan, arrived to take over, Maisie explained that she would be joining Miss Tilly for a few minutes, but didn't expect to be served. "Is the old duck unhappy about something?" Susan asked. "That old duck taught me everything I know," said Maisie, with a grin. When 5 o'clock struck, Maisie walked across the room and took the seat opposite Miss Tilly. She rarely sat down with a customer, and on the few occasions she did, she had never felt at ease. "Would you care for some tea, Maisie?" "No, thank you, Miss Tilly." "I quite understand. I'll try not to keep you too long, but before I tell you my real purpose for wanting to see you, may I ask how Harry is getting on?" "I wish he'd stop growing," said Maisie. "I seem to be letting down his trousers every few weeks. At this rate, his long trousers will be short trousers before the end of the year." Miss Tilly laughed. "What about his work?" "His end-of-term report said," Maisie paused, trying to recall the exact words, "a most satisfactory start, very promising. He came top in English." "Somewhat ironic," said Miss Tilly. "If I remember correctly, that was the subject that let him down in the entrance exam." Maisie nodded, and tried not to think about the financial consequences of Harry not having read enough Thomas Hardy. "You must be very proud of him," said Miss Tilly. "And when I went to St. Mary's on Sunday, I was delighted to see that he's back in the choir." "Yes, but he now has to be satisfied with a place in the back row with the other baritones. His days as a soloist are over. But he's joined the theatre club, and because there are no girls at BGS, he's playing Ursula in the school play." "Much ado about nothing," said Miss Tilly. "Still, I mustn't waste any more of your time, so I'll come to the reason I wanted to see you." She took a sip of tea, as if she wanted to compose herself before she spoke again, and then it all came out in a rush. "I'll be 60 next month, my dear, and for some time I have been considering retiring." It had never crossed Maisie's mind that Miss Tilly wouldn't go on forever. "Miss Munday and I have been thinking about moving down to Cornwall. We have our eye on a little cottage by the sea." "You mustn't leave Bristol," Maisie wanted to say. "I love you both, and if you go, who will I turn to for advice?" "Matters came to a head last month," continued Miss Tilly, "when a local businessman made me an offer for the tea shop. It seems he wants to add it to his growing empire, and although I don't care for the idea of Tilly's being part of a chain, his offer was far too tempting to turn down out of hand." Maisie only had one question, but she didn't interrupt while Miss Tilly was in full flow.
Since then, I've been giving the matter a great deal of thought, and I decided that if you were able to come up with the same amount he has offered, I would rather you took over the business than I hand it over to a stranger. How much did he offer? 500 pounds. Maisie sighed. I'm flattered you even thought of me, she said at last. But the truth is, I don't have 500 pennies to my name, let alone 500 pounds. I was afraid you might say that, said Miss Tilly. But if you could find a backer, I feel sure they would consider the business a good investment. After all, I made a profit of 112 pounds and 10 shillings last year, which didn't include my salary. I would have let you have it for less than 500 pounds, but we found a delightful little cottage in St. Maur's, and the owners won't consider a penny less than 300. Miss Munday and I could just about survive on our savings for a year or two, but as neither of us has a pension to fall back on, the extra 200 pounds will make all the difference. Maisie was just about to tell Miss Tilly how sorry she was, but it was out of the question, when Patrick Casey strolled into the room and sat down at his usual table. It wasn't until after they'd made love that Maisie told Patrick about Miss Tilly's offer. He sat up in bed, lit a cigarette, and inhaled deeply. Raising that amount of capital shouldn't prove too difficult. After all, it's hardly Brunel trying to raise the money to build Clifton Suspension Bridge.
No, but it is Mrs. Clifton trying to raise 500 pounds when she hasn't got 2 halfpennies to rub together.
True, but you'd be able to show a cash flow and a proven income stream, not to mention the tea shop's goodwill. Mind you, I'll need to look at the books for the past 5 years and make sure you've been told the whole story.
Miss Tilly would never try to deceive anyone.
You'll also have to check that there isn't a rent review due in the near future, Patrick said, ignoring her protestations, and double-check that her accountant hasn't come up with penalty clauses the moment you start making a profit.
Miss Tilly wouldn't do something like that, said Maisie.
You are so trusting, Maisie. What you have to remember is, this won't be in the hands of Miss Tilly, but a lawyer who feels he's got to earn his fee, and an accountant looking for a payday in case you don't retain him.
You've clearly never met Miss Tilly.
Your faith in the old lady is touching, Maisie, but my job is to protect people like you, and £112 10 shillings profit a year wouldn't be enough for you to live on, remembering you'll be expected to make regular